hung up, grabbed his mobile, and headed to change. 10 minutes later, Hanley sat on the front porch of his hillside home, looking out over a dirty strip of water in the marina just 50 yards from the embassy. He pulled out his phone and opened the Signal messaging app. Using the voice calling feature, he tapped in the number Gentry had given him, then waited. When Gentry answered, Hanley lit into him immediately.
Jesus Christ, Violator, why the fuck are you calling me at the embassy?
I knew your station, but I didn't have your personal number.
Hanley knew this, but he also knew to remonstrate.
Next question. Why the fuck are you calling me at all?
I need to tell you something, and I need you to tell me something.
Hanley rubbed his tired eyes. The warm, dank air outside here caused him to perspire even more than when he lay in bed.
What do you need to tell me?
Court spoke softly now.
Murad Khan.
The burly station chief sat up straighter.
That's a name I have not heard in a very long time.
Same here.
Never wanted to hear it again, actually.
Same here.
So, why are you calling me up at 2 in the morning and whispering it into my ear?
Because the rumors of his death have been greatly exaggerated.
Hanley looked out over the water. He felt his heart jitter and jolt a little, and he squeezed the phone tighter in an attempt to keep his hand from shaking.
Don't tell me that.
I saw him, on a job. Tracked him to Mumbai. He's here now, and he's in play.
But CIA confirmed his DNA. Back then, he's been dead 12 years.
Hanley added,
he needs to stay dead.
That DNA came from the Pakistanis, right?
I don't recall, but probably so. There wasn't much to work with, as I remember.
He staged his death. Maybe with help from ISI, maybe not. He's been around this whole time.
Hanley's eyes went glassy.
That's not possible.
Ask yourself, Matt, would I, of all people, make a mistake like this?
The station chief on his little porch heaved a long sigh.
Not in a million years.
He rubbed his meaty face with a hand like a catcher's mitt, then said,
What's he doing in India?
Unknown, but he's here working B Company.
The Indian mob? That's curious.
He was in Algiers 3 days ago. I was told he was working on a way to manufacture counterfeit rupees. Indian intel knew about it, apparently, but they didn't know it was Khan, just someone from FCU. They thought ISI was doing it to try to destabilize their economy, but again, they didn't know who they were up against.
Khan wouldn't be currency dumping, not his style.
Agreed. Something bigger is going on.
Hanley heaved a heavy sigh.
But why are you calling me? I figured Khan had been taking a dirt nap since back then. How would I know what he's doing now?
He paused.
I can get the local office there in Mumbai working on it. I can say I got an anonymous tip or some bullshit.
I have a feeling our timeline is shorter than we'd like.
Hanley sighed again.
Always was with that motherfucker.
Right. I'm calling to ask if you had any back-channel relationships around these parts, here or in Pakistan. Someone I could reach out to for more information. I'm not leaving here till I kill Murad Khan. I can promise you that. But I need help finding him.
Hanley answered back in an instant.
Yeah, actually, you might be in luck. There's a guy in Mumbai, a guy I wouldn't say I think much of personally. We ran up against each other a lot back in the day. But he's a man who knows the area, and he knows all about Murad Khan and what happened back then.
He's RNAW?
Negative. He's American, actually. Ex-agency. He was the station chief in Islamabad when all that shit went down, right when you joined Gulf Sierra.
What's he doing here?
Retired. He's been out of the field so long, home wasn't home anymore. Happens more than you might guess.
I'd guess it happens a lot.
More than a lot, then. He ended up in Mumbai. He'd worked there as an ops officer earlier in his career.
What does he know?
Back then, he knew everybody. A specialist on India as well as Pakistan. I can get you an address. You should pay him a visit. Tell him what you know. Trust me, the second you convince him Khan is alive, he'll help you in any way he can.
Why is that?
That whole affair is what forced him into retirement.
Shit.
Court said.
Yeah, we all have our motivations for finishing what we started back then.
Court changed gears suddenly.
Hey, Matt, is there any word about me? Is Langley in hot pursuit, or is it more like lukewarm pursuit, like when you were running the show?
Hanley sighed.
Kid, I was sent to the hinterlands for what happened in Germany. I don't know anything about what's going on with the hunt for you. I still plan on clawing my way out of this hole I've been tossed down, and when I do, you know I'll have your back, but I don't know when that will be.
Roger that. Did you hear about Brewer?
Suzanne Brewer had been Court's handler in Hanley's Sub Rosa unit codenamed Poison Apple. Court didn't like or trust her, but Hanley kept her around anyway.
Court said, "You think you are in the hinterlands? I didn't hear anything about anybody."
Matt said, "She got promoted. She works as a special assistant to the dept director for ops."
"Damn, you went down, she went up."
"Yeah, well, anyway. If anyone's hunting you aggressively, it's probably gonna be Brewer."
Court said, "She couldn't find me when I worked with her. Doubt she'll find me now."
"Just keep your head down."
Matt added,
"I'm glad to hear you're working, and I'm not surprised you are being a hell of a lot more productive than I am."
"Don't know how productive I'm being. Just got a guy killed tonight."
Hanley thought this over.
"You have the shittiest job in the shittiest industry on Earth. Hang in there, Violator. I'll run this con stuff up the flagpole with Langley somehow."
"Don't," Court said. "Right now, Khan's freaking out because he knows that someone recognized him in Algiers, but he doesn't know who I am. If he knew he'd been exposed to the CIA.
Hanley took over.
"Then whatever he's planning would happen even faster than it would otherwise. Got it. I'll sit on this till you get back to me."
"Yeah. Let's let him feel like he's still somewhat secure. I'll go meet this ex-COS, see if he knows anything about B Company and their ties to Pakistani intel."
Hanley said,
"Give me a half hour to find him, and I'll text you on this number."
He stood up from the chair on his porch and said,
"Violator, be careful.
You know me."
To this, Hanley just repeated himself.
"Hell yeah, I do. Be careful."
Court Gentry had been walking the streets of Versova while he talked to Hanley, but he returned to the dark and tiny flat above the fish market now and handed Priyanka Bhandari a new burner cell phone he'd purchased in a convenience store. He wrote the number down on his hand, then said he had to go back out to see a man for more information about Khan. Priya had just made it back to the flat herself after buying electronics at a 24-hour shop nearby. Twice already, she'd almost attached the hard drive she'd taken from Arjun's laptop to her own to watch the dreadful files again. But both times, she'd told herself there would be nothing to gain from this other than more pain and torment. So as Cobalt headed out the back door, she sat on a yoga mat and did her best to meditate. A half hour after Cobalt left her there alone, however, she climbed off the mat, stepped over to her laptop sitting on a little futon in the tiny living room, pulled the hard drive out of her small backpack, and plugged it in. She knew what she would see, but at this moment, she only wanted to punish herself for getting her poor, sweet uncle killed. She watched the entire event, only averting her eyes as her uncle was tortured. She listened to him shout and scream, profess that he knew nothing about the man she knew as Cobalt, and nothing about who hired him for the job, other than he assumed it was someone with the research and analysis wing. He explained to Khan that the entire operation was brokered over the darknet, and he therefore had no information to give him. Over and over he begged Khan to kill him. Priya turned away again before he screamed her name, and she kept her eyes averted until after the Pakistani man slit her uncle's throat. When it was over, she made to get up from the futon, but instead, she went back to the beginning of the file and started it again. She was ashamed for turning away from what she had caused. For what she had put her uncle through, she told herself that sitting here comfortably and witnessing it was a pathetically cheap price to pay, but it was the only penance she could think of. On this third viewing, she forced herself to watch the torture. She even zoomed in on Arjun's face, taking in every ounce of abuse he took, even if only through osmosis. As he screamed and cried, she leaned closer, touched her fingers to the screen, as if wiping away the blood that ran down from above his eye. She took her hand away slowly, and as she did this,
She saw Arjun's head turn and face the camera, staring right into it. She tapped a key, freezing the video. At first, she wondered how she'd missed this on her earlier viewings, but she realized she'd had her eyes averted at this point of the video. And even now, only by zooming in, could she know for sure that he was purposefully looking into the camera high in the corner. She pushed the play button again, and just then he shouted, "Priya." She'd heard this 3 times already now, yet still her blood ran cold at the screeching sound of her name. She went back 30 seconds and watched it again, zoomed in more closely. Now she realized he was looking into the camera for several seconds, right before he shouted her name. And his mouth moved, although she heard no sound from it. She zoomed in tighter. He was mouthing something, something directly to her, and that was why he'd shouted her name. "Of course," she told herself. Of course he knew she would come, and she would know about the covert camera, and she would review the footage. But what was he saying? She had no idea, but she did know how to find out. In the end, it took her almost an hour to digitally clean up the footage. She slowed it down even more, zoomed in even tighter, to where she could see only his bloody face. Priya had learned how to read lips from watching thousands of hours of security camera footage over the years, and now she watched his mouth over and over and over until there could be no doubt as to what he was saying. It was a string of numbers. 14, 44, 27, 41.
"What on earth?"
she muttered softly in Hindi. This wasn't a phone number. This meant nothing. But then she realized what her uncle was doing. He was giving her the combination to his safe.
"But why?"
She solved this riddle quickly as well. There was something in the safe that she needed to see. It was her uncle's dying wish for her to go look. Without giving it a second thought, Priya wrote the combination down, then grabbed her backpack and her keys, and she left the apartment over the fish market, hunting for a taxi.
34. 12 years ago. At a CIA safe house in Lahore, just 15 minutes' drive to the KRF location at the Hotel Days Inn, the entire 6-man ground branch team leaned over a laptop with a satellite image of the hotel and the surrounding area displayed. It wasn't in real time, there was too much cloud cover right now, but the shot had been taken the day before. Hanley had told them that the man they suspected of being Pasha the Kashmiri was at the location, and he indicated which man he was in the photo Gentry had taken just a couple of hours earlier. He also notified Zack that the man's actual name was Murad Khan, and he worked for the ISI. Zack didn't care, and neither did the others standing in the simple home. If the green light for the hit came through, they'd drop him in the dirt with a bullet to the brain, just the same as anyone else at the location. Although they were getting some information about the location from the satellite image, they also did have visual coverage on the property. Kendrick Lennox had installed a camera on the roof of the building across the alleyway, and it beamed images of the parking lot and rear walls of the 3-story structure through another laptop they had open. Since the hotel was up on stanchions, effectively making the ground floor an open but covered parking lot with a staircase in the middle, the camera's view showed most of the front side of the hotel lot as well. And now, as when the team left an hour earlier, the parking lot contained the red minibus and 3 Toyota Hilux pickup trucks. To the best of anyone's knowledge, the AN had not been offloaded from the minibus, and the CIA analyst back at Camp Chapman said there was, indeed, something heavy enough inside to push the frame low on the chassis. On the live feed, the men could see that the rain had stopped, and now 4 men milled around the parking lot, rifles on their backs. Another man was on the roof, observing the busy city outside the walls of the property. Zack said, "Okay, the exterior of the property is protected by 5 packs. The rest seem to be inside. We are working under the assumption that the AN is still on the minibus, and there's no way they've mixed it with diesel yet to make a proper bomb." Lennox said, "But that shit will still go up with a detonator." "That's right," Zack agreed. "There's enough ammonium nitrate in there to take out a city block." Court asked, "Do we think they are just going to lay up there till nightfall, then go to another location?" Zack shrugged. "It's possible, but they could also move out at any time. We need that green light from Hanley,
and we need the guns and gear from Islamabad station. Court told Zack he wanted to return to the parking lot across the street, just to have a physical, human intelligence asset there in case there was something else that could be learned before the raid. A couple of the other men rolled their eyes at this. Morgan said,
"Boy Wonder wants to hit this bitch by himself."
"I'm not going to hit it, I'm going to reconnoiter it." Zack wasn't opposed to the idea, but he didn't like Court going alone. This was still under discussion when Zack's sat phone rang, and he put it on speaker.
"Go for Golf Sierra 1.
"Golf Sierra 1, this is Rooster. Green light. Say again, green light."
Hanley continued.
"A vehicle will arrive at your paws within 60 mics with rifles and body armor. You are cleared hot to hit the Hotel Days Inn as soon as possible. It's got to be a hasty plan, Sierra 1. There is no way to track them if they try to leave."
"Understood. We've got it figured out."
"Your primary target is Murad Khan. Your secondary is the ammonium nitrate. Tertiary is Mufti. How copy?"
"Good copy."
When he hung up, Zack said,
"Me and Six will go back to the south side of the location now to get a better view. When the equipment comes, you four kit up. Pace, take the Suzuki and bring our shit to us. We'll slap on our gear and we'll all hit from both sides, 3 and 3.
The men rogered up, Court included, and then Zack and Court climbed into the Toyota and not the Suzuki because they didn't want to loiter in the same vehicle they'd brought to the fertility clinic before, in case the man on the roof of the hotel was extraordinarily skilled in counter-surveillance. Court and Zack took off, carrying only their Glock pistols and some extra magazines. 15 minutes later, they were in the parking lot of the fertility clinic. Looking across the street for only a moment, the men realized something was different. The security men were not visible through the gate, nor was the one on the roof of the hotel. Zack looked at the image on the other side of the street on his iPad, and there was no movement back there either. Soon enough, through the metal gate, they watched as men began filing out of the stairwell, carrying large duffel bags, walking through the parking lot, and then loading the bags into the back of the minibus. Zack said,
"Is that thing a fucking clown car? It's got 3 forklift loads of AN in there, and now they are putting in 6, 7 big duffels?"
Court said,
"They might have offloaded the AN.
Zack replied,
"We would have seen them do it."
Court disagreed.
"They were here a good 5 minutes before we had visual through the gate on this side, and we can't see the minibus from here. And Sierra 2 didn't mount that camera on the east side for another 20. 8 or 10 guys could have carried those sacks into the hotel."
"Yeah," Zack admitted.
"The hotel might be the bomb."
Zack reported what they saw both to the rest of the team and to Hanley at the Tactical Operations Center back at Chapman. While he did this, the Kashmiri resistance fighters continued loading items into the minibus. While Zack talked to Hanley, Court said,
"Something's got them spooked." "Wait one, Rooster."
Zack looked at the iPad and then across the street through the gate.
"Yeah, I think you're right."
Hanley asked,
"What's going on?"
"These fuckers are loading up, boss, but they're rushing it too, like they're agitated."
"Shit," Hanley said. "We need to end this today."
"Understood."
Court said,
"What are we going to do?"
Zack replied,
"If they unass that hotel before the rest of the team gets here, then we just do our best to tail them. They drive that thing up to the front of the U.S. Embassy and..."
"The embassy is in Islamabad. If the target is in Lahore, then it's the consulate.
Or something else,"
Hanley asked.
"What's the ETA on the rest of your team?"
Zack said.
"About 7 mics now. I can change the play here, bring the entire team to my side when they get here and we ram the gate. We can stop that bus from moving out of here at least."
The group chief said,
"Those aren't great odds."
"Higher stakes, lower odds, boss. Same as ever."
"Copy,"
Hanley replied. Just then, the gate across the street slid open. Court said,
"Shit, they're leaving. But we don't know how many guys and how much shit is still in that building."
Zack was thinking quickly now.
"Kid, can you tail that minibus on your own?"
"Of course I can,"
Gentry said with all the swagger of a young man. Zack started the engine, then opened his driver's side door, but only a little. Court started to get out on his side, but Zack called to him.
"Hold, hold, hold."
Across the street, the red minibus pulled out of the hotel property and turned in their direction. It passed them by, gaining speed and heading to the north. They saw 2 men in the front seats, but they didn't recognize either of them.
"Now,"
Zack said,
and Court launched out of the minivan, running to the other side. Zack remained there next to the driver's side door. He said,
I'm going to lead the assault on the hotel. Then you can vector us to wherever that Vic is when we're done.
Got it,
Court said as he sat down behind the wheel. Zack added,
stay in comms and good luck.
But Court was already shutting his door. He lurched forward, then turned onto Nazaria E. Pakistan Avenue and headed off in the direction of the red vehicle. As soon as Court drove out of the fertility clinic, Zack clicked his radio transmitter.
Sierra 2, Sierra 1, you up on this net?
Affirmative 1, we are about 6 minutes out.
Then you are 7 minutes too late. The minibus is rolling, unknown who is inside, but 6 is tailing it.
Want us to link with him?
Negative. We don't know what's in the hotel. I'll wait for you. We hit this location from the main gate and clear it. Link up with 6 after that.
Copy that. We're hauling ass.
Inside the Hotel Days Inn, the director of the Foreign Coordination Unit of the ISI, 35-year-old Murad Khan, looked out a third-story window with Omar Mufti, his second-in-command, standing at his side. Together they watched the street, looked up and down it for the CIA men they'd been warned were now getting ready to strike the location. Mufti was agitated, but Khan was calm. Softly, with no small amount of reverence, he said,
the sacrifice our brothers will make today will long be remembered.
Did we have to send so many?
Yes. There will be questions about the size of the explosion. An 8-man force along with the material should cause enough havoc to reassure our enemies that this was the true objective. You've had this planned all along, haven't you, brother?
Khan smiled a little.
A backup plan. In case we were discovered before we had time to enact our true mission, all those men in that bus knew this day might come.
Mufti nodded, still looking out the window. His leader's voice was the epitome of calm, but Mufti himself was still nervous.
The Americans will be here soon. I trust you have a plan for us, too?
A plan for us, a plan for the material downstairs, and a plan for our brothers on their way to martyrdom.
He smiled and put his hand on Mufti's shoulder.
I have a plan for everything, Major.
35. 5 minutes later, Court found himself moving along in the Toyota at a snail's pace. The minibus was up ahead, still well in sight, but the choking traffic on the big avenue made it next to impossible for him to close any ground on the vehicle. He watched his target turn off on a service road a minute later, and there was little traffic on it, so the KRF terrorists began racing off to the northeast. Court felt panic wash over him. He couldn't go forward or backwards, nor could he simply exit until he hit the service road, which, at this pace, would take him several minutes to get to. So he did the only thing he could think to do. He put the minivan in park, leapt out, and began running through traffic. Cars honked behind him in protest of his leaving a vehicle in the middle of the congested road, but Court ran on, as fast as his legs would take him. He felt the comforting pressure of the Glock 19 he had secured in an inside-the-waistband retention holster in his pants on the right side, its grip covered by his light gray t-shirt, along with the comforting pressure of the magazine holder, IWB, on his left side, which carried 2 more 15-round mags. He made it 1 block to the north, still sprinting with everything he had. Here, he saw a raised footbridge that ran parallel to the service road over a culvert, and he took the stairs up, 2 and 3 at a time. Once above the culvert, he peered into the distance. The red minibus was just visible in the haze and smog and dim evening's light, but he was able to see it make another turn for the north. Court ran on. He was nearly half a mile behind the vehicle now, and he was on foot. It seemed like a hopeless endeavor at first, but when he saw a young man climbing onto a scooter just off the sidewalk ahead of him, Court slowed, drew his pistol, and stuck it in the man's ribs when he made it to within contact distance.
Sorry, brother. I need this more than you do right now.
The man was stunned into immediate compliance. He climbed off, Court climbed on, and he fired the engine and raced to the east. He turned sharply to the north when he came to a small road that bisected the one the minibus had just turned off on. He had no visual on his target now, and he hadn't for the past minute. He sped as fast as he could on the little scooter, his head scanning left and right into the parking lots and side roads. But when Court made it to the road he had seen the vehicle turn onto, he realized it was, in actuality, a long driveway that led to a massive shopping center.
He raced along it, past a sign that said, Goldberg Galleria, and he thought there was a fair chance that this was the destination of the terrorists. His blood ran cold. He kept his scooter racing at top speed through the parking lot, standing on the footrest at times to look for the red minibus. The cars were everywhere, people moving to and from them, to and from the entrances of the mall. If the terrorists were targeting this location, Court knew it would be a bloodbath. Finally, after making it halfway around the massive structure, he called Hightower on his radio.
Sierra 6 for Sierra 1, how copy?
Zack came over the net, though his voice was scratchy due to the distance between them.
Sierra 1 copies. The team is pulling up in one mic. Say your status and pause, and make it quick, over. I'm at the Goldberg Galleria, about 5 clicks from you. The target vehicle entered the parking lot. I've lost Viz, but I'm hunting for them. They could be here, or they could have gone out another exit. You can't lose that Vic, 6.
Court had, without question, lost the Vic, but he wasn't ready to admit defeat to Sierra 1.
Scanning now. If they are here at the mall, then you know what that means, right?
Zack wasn't so sure.
Ammonium nitrate by itself isn't enough of a bang for this group, and attacking a soft target in Pakistan? That doesn't seem like their big play here. They've done it before, though, right? Yeah, little hit and runs, but if Pasha and Mufti are personally involved...
Zack sounded rushed.
Look, 6, find them, stay on their asses, but get off this net. The team is here and we are rolling as soon as I get my gear on.
Sierra 2 pulled his van up next to Sierra 1, who was standing alone in the parking lot of the fertility clinic, around the corner from the street so he couldn't be seen by anyone in the hotel. The side door of the green vehicle slid open, and Zack climbed inside, and he was instantly handed a load-bearing vest. The weapons the team had been provided were folding-stocked AKs that looked like they hadn't been in use since the 70s, but Zack knew local assets hadn't had much time to cobble together an armory full of equipment for the ground branch team. And he and the 4 men with him now had all been well-trained on the Kalashnikov platform. Zack did a quick function check on the weapon handed to him by Morgan and found it to be in fair condition. More magazines were already stuck in the chest rig he wore, as were heavy steel ballistic plates to absorb rounds should he be shot in the torso. As soon as he velcroed the cummerbund of his vest tight across his midsection and racked the bolt of the AK, Zack crawled past Morgan and Rittus in the back of the van and stuck his head between the front seats. Here, Kendrick Lennox was behind the wheel on the left, and Jim Pace was riding shotgun on the right.
How we doing this?
Lennox asked.
Zack was unequivocal. Ram the gate. We'll debus and stack up. Move to the stairwell and ascend. Stay together.
Kendrick Lennox replied.
Got it.
Zack slapped him on the back.
Go!
Lennox put the van in gear and started to roll forward, pulled out of the fertility clinic parking lot, made a right, and picked up speed as he closed on the metal gate of the darkened hotel building across the street. But just as he spun the steering wheel to force the van hard to the left to hit the gate from a right angle, a Lahore City police vehicle passing in oncoming traffic slammed on its brakes, blocking the gate. Lennox had committed to the turn, however, so he was shot towards the hotel and slammed into the police car, knocking it sideways into the gate, simultaneously slamming the Americans around in the van. Zack looked out the window and saw a second, then a third police car skid to a stop around them, effectively boxing in the van, except for the rear.
Reverse! Reverse!
Zack shouted. Lennox jammed the van's transmission into reverse to get out of there. He stomped on the gas, but he instantly impacted with a fourth police car that was sliding to a stop behind the van. The Americans were surrounded. Cops poured out of the 4 vehicles, and the men heard sirens approaching, indicating there were a lot more cops on the way.
Son of a bitch!
Hightower shouted. The men put their hands up as guns were pointed at them through the windshield. There was no scenario that involved killing local cops, so turning this into a gun battle wasn't an option. Zack looked through the windshield now and saw men looking out of the stairwell at the ground floor of the hotel. He wondered how many terrorists were standing about 50 feet from him right now, and he felt helpless to do anything about it. And then he thought of Gentry, alone, up against a second unknown number of terrorists, armed only with a pistol. But there was nothing Zack and Golf Sierra could do to help him now. Court Gentry found the target vehicle 2 minutes after entering the parking lot, illegally parked in a loading zone just outside the main entrance at the northernmost portion of the mall. Even from a distance, he could see that the minibus looked lighter on its chassis than it had before, and this told him that some or all of the men, or some or all of the equipment, were no longer in sight.
Quickly, his head shot to the right, towards the row of doors leading into the multi-level shopping center. There, he saw what appeared to be about 8 men, all carrying large backpacks, heading towards the front door. Cort sped in their direction and watched them disappear inside the entrance before he got to them. He parked his scooter next to the minibus and called Zack on the radio. Zack had ordered him to stay off the net, but this development, in Cort's estimation, warranted the communication.
Sierra 6 for Sierra 1.
There was no reply. He tried again as he climbed off the scooter, and once more he approached the minibus on foot, but he received no response from Hightower. Attempting to look inside, he found that the back windows had been covered with black paper. He moved around to the front, but he couldn't see what was in back because a tarp hung from the headliner down to the floor behind the two front seats. Cort gave up on reaching Zack and on getting a look inside the locked vehicle. Instead, he began running towards the mall entrance, past men and women who looked at him curiously. He had just pulled the door open, 45 seconds behind the group of men with backpacks, though he couldn't see them near the entrance, when he heard the first echoing booms of gunshots coming from inside the building. Murad Khan stood with his arms crossed at the bottom of the hotel staircase, 5 kilometers away from where the terrorist event he'd ordered began. But he wasn't thinking about the Gulberg Galleria. Instead, he watched while a group of 5 Westerners, he'd been told they were from the CIA, were pulled out of the van that sat damaged sideways and smoking in the street in front of him. The armor-clad men were thrown up against the hood and trunk of the wrecked-out police car pressed up against the gate. Khan smiled as he made eye contact with a tall, bearded, blonde-haired man, who quickly disappeared from view as he was yanked with the others down to the ground, just as a large armored police van pulled up and stopped in the fading light. The men were handcuffed and loaded into the windowless and secure back cabin, along with 2 Pakistani police officers, and the heavy steel door was slammed shut. Omar Mufti still stood at his leader's right shoulder.
When they take the Americans away, will the police come in here to check what they were after?
No, Khan said with confidence. In moments, they will have something else on their mind. We'll transport the chemicals as soon as they leave.
Then, that's it? Everything stays the same with the plan?
No, Khan said again. We will have to speed up the attack.
We can't, Mufti replied.
He was subordinate to Murad Khan, Pasha, the Kashmiri, but he was also an army officer, and he knew how to assert himself even to his superiors.
We need a week to do it properly.
Khan did not reply to Mufti. Instead, he turned to another man in the room, standing back from the doorway.
Nasir, what about your end of the operation? Can it be sped up?
Nasir Rasool was in his 20s, bespectacled, and he wore Western clothes.
The team from China requires time to set up and test their equipment on site, and weather conditions can't be relied upon. We have to move under cloud cover on the night of the attack to have any chance for success. Heavy clouds are predicted by the weekend.
Khan then turned back to Mufti.
We will act in 5 days then.
Khan put a hand on the shoulder of Mufti and another on the shoulder of Rasool.
Relax, both of you.
With his head, he motioned to the police vehicles out on the street. The Americans were already rolling off to the north in the back of the black paddy wagon.
I know what the CIA is going to do as soon as they do. Look at them. They are flailing. We are moving ever closer to our goal. Our endeavor will be met with glorious success. I promise you both.
36. At the Gulberg Galleria, a mall security officer armed with a revolver on his hip stood near the front doors, staring at the sounds coming from somewhere in the mall, but out of his line of sight. He was slow to understand what was happening, so Cort grabbed the man by the arm to get his attention.
Do you speak English?
The man nodded.
Get on your radio. Move everybody out of here and call the police. Tell them there are 8 terrorists and there might be a bomb in the red bus out there.
He pointed back through the doors, then took off in a run, delaying drawing his pistol because he didn't want the rent-a-cop to see the weapon and then reflexively shoot him in the back. More gunfire rang out. It was coming from different vectors, and this told Cort the men had probably split into smaller groups. Cort had never dealt with terrorism. This all felt like someone else's war, stuff he'd been watching on TV for the last decade. But even though this shit was nothing like he'd ever experienced, he knew he'd have to figure out his enemy's tactics on the fly. He came to a T-intersection in the center of the Galleria. Men and women and children by the dozens sprinted past him, rushing for the exits. He heard sustained shooting from both the left and the right, so he quickly scanned both directions. He saw nothing on his right but a long concourse of shops, open to three levels of stores above it. He knew there hadn't been enough time for anyone to ascend to another level, so he wondered if the attackers who'd move this way were already inside a store here on the ground floor. When he looked to his left, however, he immediately saw two armed men on an escalator heading up, backpacks slung over their shoulders and AK-47 rifles raised to fire. Civilians ran in all directions on the main floor of the mall, and he saw blood and bodies among them. The two men on the escalator gunned down a security guard who looked over the second floor railing, and then an older couple who were caught in the open on the escalator heading down. Court took off in this direction, fought his way through fleeing mall patrons, and finally drew his weapon when he was at the bottom of the escalator. The two men continued shooting as they reached the top, concentrating their attention and their fire at targets they could see on the second floor. Court aimed as he jumped onto the escalator and fired a single shot, hitting the first man above him in the small of his back. The terrorist pitched forward into his partner, knocking the other man onto the second floor at the top of the escalator and out of Court's line of fire. Court ascended at a run, but when he lost sight of the second man, he realized all the KRF fighter would have to do was reach his weapon over the top of the escalator and fire down, and Court would have no way to avoid being raked with rounds. So he kicked his legs over the side and dropped 10 feet back to the ground floor and into the middle of a group of panicked civilians. He collapsed his body to absorb the impact, then rolled on the floor up to a kneeling position. Gunfire ripped the escalator above where he'd been an instant earlier, validating his decision about remaining there in the open. Court climbed off the floor of the Galleria now, and he was instantly met by more gunfire, coming from somewhere down the mall on his right. AK rounds sprayed into the masses around him. He saw a woman fall, and he hit the ground again to avoid getting shot. Looking back up, he noticed a young boy standing alone in the center of the concourse, some 50 feet away from him. Court leapt to his feet and went for the kid through the crowd. He had no idea if the parents had been killed or just pushed away in the frenzied jumble. He heard gunfire now from three different locations, confirming his assumption that the terrorists had split into groups, probably into groups of two, so that one man could cover while his partner reloaded. Court ran in a crouch all the way to the kid. The boy couldn't have been older than 4, and he scooped him up with his left arm while his right shifted the Glock around, hunting for a target. He burst into the first refuge he could find, a clothing store called Alkaram Studio. With echoing gunfire outside the mall, he put the boy down next to an employee who was crouched behind her counter.
"Take care of him."
She just stared in shock.
"Do you speak English?"
Yes.
"You have a back door?"
It leads to a rear employee hallway.
"Go. These guys are looking for a big kill. They won't worry about the employee access areas for a while."
Court turned and ran back out the door, and as soon as he looked to the left, he saw just a glimpse of one of the terrorists as he ambled along at a comfortable pace, disappearing into a Nike store. Quickly, Court scanned what little he could see of the three levels of the mall above him, afraid that the man he'd left alive from the escalator, or one of the other Kashmiris, would start taking pot shots over the railing down at those on the ground floor. Upstairs to his left and to his right, Kashmiri separatists were indiscriminately gunning down everyone they saw, focusing first on the several poorly armed security men who died valiantly, but died nonetheless. But he only heard this by reading the sound of the gunfire. He didn't see any oppo close to the upstairs railing, so he took a chance. He ran out into the mall concourse, sprinting closer to the Nike store. He stopped before he reached the door, instead looking through the glass window, past a display of mannequins in fitness gear, and he saw two armed men pushing several customers and staff up against a wall. They raised their AKs to fire, and Court realized he had to act now. He aimed and pressed his trigger over and over through the glass, shattering it. The first terrorist took a round to the arm, and then the second pitched over, but Court couldn't tell where he'd hit the man. With the first man still on his feet but focusing on his wound, Court crashed through the now broken glass, made it into the store, and found some cover behind a sales counter. He rose up from behind the counter and fired again at the KRF fighter, this time hitting him twice in the chest as he searched in vain for a target. Court dropped to his butt behind the counter again, ejected the nearly empty magazine from his gun, and stuck it in his back pocket. He pounded in a fresh mag, then clawed around the side of the counter to peek out at a different angle. But before he'd made it around the side, he heard a single gunshot in the back of the store where the civilians had been lined up. He leapt to his feet, aimed in again, hunting for a target, and saw a middle-aged man in a white dress shirt holding an AK pointing it down.
This was not one of the terrorists, Court realized, just as his finger began pressing on the Glock's trigger, so he let off the pressure and yelled at the man.
Drop it!
The man did as ordered, letting the weapon clank on the tile floor and then raising his hands high in the air in terror. Court moved around a display and was able to see what had happened. The second man Court had shot through the glass had fallen to the floor, but he'd survived. He'd dropped his rifle and tried to crawl away, but a civilian had picked it up and finished the man off. Court ordered the middle-aged civilian to put his hands down and guide the rest of the people out of the mall via the back hallway, then raced forward, holstered his pistol, and picked up a blood-covered Kalashnikov. He did a mag change off the vest worn by the dead guy who was lying face up, and he noticed the weapon had a high-end red-dot optic sight, as well as a flashlight mounted to the side that could be activated with a pressure switch. It was a quality gun, and money had been spent to upgrade it. He grabbed a second full rifle mag out of the man's chest rack and turned to run back towards the mezzanine. By his count, three of the terrorists were down now, but there were at least five more, and he could still hear AKs rattling somewhere in the mall. In the back of the police truck, the five Americans of Ground Branch Team Golf Sierra sat on benches along the walls, their bodies swaying with the driver's turns. The men in back were accompanied by a pair of Pakistani SWAT officers wearing Heckler & Koch MP5 submachine guns around their necks, sitting by the rear door of the vehicle and watching the prisoners to make sure they didn't get any bright ideas about an escape. It was silent, other than sporadic but routine-sounding broadcasts on the cops' radios hanging from their chests, broadcasts the Americans didn't understand because they were spoken in Urdu. Finally, Zack leaned back against the thick wall of the vehicle and looked around at the rest of his team.
Does it seem odd to anybody else that the local 5-0 just happened to get this paddy wagon on scene in under 2 minutes?
Lennox said.
And when they pulled us out of the van, they immediately yanked our earpieces. They didn't just stumble onto them.
Pace added.
They didn't just stumble onto us either.
Redis said directly what Sierra 1, 2, and 4 were inferring.
Somebody told the cops not just that we were here, but who we were.
The two police officers sat across from each other on the two benches, looking at the handcuffed group. They said nothing, just eyed the tough-looking Americans, who somehow still managed to look tough with their hands secured behind their backs. It went silent again for a moment, Zack spending the quiet thinking about how the hell the embassy in Islamabad was going to react when they learned the Ground Branch team got popped by the local popo and was being taken to some shithole prison in Lahore. When suddenly, a new burst of radio traffic came over the two cops' radios. Again, Zack and his team couldn't understand a word, but there was shouting, a quick barking of indecipherable words, and unmistakable panic in the voice of the broadcaster. The Golf Sierra men looked around at one another.
That don't sound good,
Morgan said. One of the cops radioed back, and the net came alive with near-constant radio traffic, and soon the van, which had been rolling along at a normal pace, began speeding up, forcing the handcuffed men in the back to brace themselves with their feet. Zack looked up to the cop on the opposite bench from him.
What's going on?
The man appeared dialed in, focused, even more so than when he was guarding over a team of American gunmen. He said,
Terror attack at Galleria! We go there now! You stay locked in here!
Zack knew Court was in the middle of whatever was going on, and he pulled against his cuffs behind his back in frustration. He looked to the others, then back to the cop.
How far? Not far. We will help with the perimeter, and then when it is over, we will take you all to jail.
Hightower rolled his eyes.
You don't need to worry about a fucking perimeter. This is what me and my guys are trained for. You need to let us go in there.
The man shook his head, looked at his partner, and they both laughed a little, though nervously.
You go nowhere but jail, American.
Zack eyed the man, then said,
At least tell your driver that if he sees a red minibus outside the mall, he might want to think about not parking next to it.
Now the cop cocked his head.
Why not? Because it's a fucking bomb, dipshit!
The cop looked at Zack angrily for a few seconds, and then the young man reached down for his radio. He broadcast something in Urdu, then received a reply, possibly from the driver of the paddy wagon. The police officer then looked back to Zack.
No more talking.
Court gentry raced towards the sound of gunfire, past the lifeless forms of civilians strewn around the first floor concourse as he kept his eyes scanning the mezzanines above him, still terrified he'd see a rifle poke over a railing and then aim down at him, like he was a fish in a barrel. Observing the dead, he realized he'd never seen carnage like this in his life. He'd killed. He was still a teenager the first time he took a life.
but he'd never seen innocents targeted until earlier that day, and it simultaneously sickened, frightened, and angered him to his core. There was a new burst of automatic gunfire one level up. He took a quick glance at a sign near an escalator and thought the shooting might be coming from the mall's food court. Court bypassed the escalator and continued running. Though it would be the fastest way up to the second level, he also knew it could remain a fatal funnel of fire if an armed man was up there and looking down. Instead, he ran through a doorway marked with an exit sign, raced through a narrow and poorly lit employee access hallway, and finally found a set of concrete stairs that he thought might take him upstairs to the southern side of the food court. Gunfire around the mall had lessened considerably, but it had not stopped. Court imagined that the terrorists no longer had the target-rich environment of an unsuspecting mall filled to the brim with potential victims, and now they were simply going from store to store, looking for anyone who had hidden in hopes of weathering this attack in safety. On the second level, he left the employee stairwell on the south side, but immediately heard fresh shooting and determined it was still above him and not, in fact, at the food court. He ran back to the stairs, his AK up and trained, and ascended another floor. He burst out the third-floor employee access door, his heart pounding from the exertion and the terror and the utter panic that came from the realization that every time he heard a gunshot, and he'd heard hundreds, another innocent man, woman, or child might have been killed. It was less than 20 seconds before he caught a glimpse of someone stepping into a Tag Heuer store. The man was armed with a black AK. He was no longer carrying a backpack, and he moved at an angle to where Court couldn't be sure the man hadn't seen him. Slowly, Court advanced, trying to get an angle on the man 50 feet away inside the high-end watch store. He caught himself hoping to hear gunfire inside, indicating the man was directing his attention somewhere else, but he also knew that would mean more dead innocents, so he pushed the thought out of his mind and kept moving. He looked off the mezzanine, down to his right, and saw the mall's entrance, and while it was nearly dark outside now, he could see flashing lights pouring off the highway and coming this way. He figured the cops would need several minutes to form en masse to come in here and help, so he wondered if Zack and the guys would get here and bail his ass out of this mess first. But he couldn't sit here and wait. The fight was going on right now, and he was on his own. The Lahore police van with the five American prisoners slowed, and inside the armored and windowless backspace, Zack could hear sirens all around. He figured he and his team were approaching the perimeter being set up around the mall. And he figured he would be sitting here inside this tin can while his Sierra 6 was fighting for his life just a couple hundred yards away. The distant boom of gunshots confirmed this. They were barely audible, but unmistakable, and Zack, in desperation, looked across to Jim Pace, Sierra 4. The men made eye contact, and then Zack flashed his eyes to the cop on Pace's left. He was giving his man the order to take the cop out, though it was going to be tough to do it with Pace's hands behind his back. Sierra 3 was on Zack's right, and also next to a police officer. Sierra 1 figured Morgan would pick up on the cue that he needed to overpower the man next to him as soon as Pace went for his target. Zack himself planned on launching off his bench and slamming a shoulder into the cop across from him, giving Pace a little support in his endeavor. This was a low-probability move all around, but Zack was desperate. The chattering AK fire in the distance, and the fact that one of the men he was responsible for was in a life-or-death gunfight meant he had to act, no matter the odds. Court lay prone behind a concrete garbage can on the third-floor mezzanine, firing his bloody AK towards the man in the Tag Heuer store. The enemy returned fire proficiently, conserving ammo but keeping Court's head down, making sure he was unable to move from the weak concealment of the garbage can and towards more cover. Court had the tactical expertise to know that this shooter was well-trained. There were several more armed enemy in this building, and they could approach Court from any direction, even shoot up at him from the mezzanine below, and there wasn't a hell of a lot he could do about it while the guy in the watch store had him pinned in the open. He concentrated on the target before him, telling himself if he could eliminate this asshole, then maybe he could advance and get some cover for when the rest of the assholes started showing up. Court looked quickly to his left and saw movement inside Punjab Optics. An armed man peeked around the wall. The young bearded fighter saw Court as well, almost out in the open on the third-floor mezzanine. Court threw himself up to his knees and slung his rifle around, turning his attention away from the Tag Heuer terrorist and focusing on the optical store terrorist. But before he could press the trigger on the AK, he saw a flash reflected off all the glass and metal surfaces of the mall around him, and then he launched into the air. He was flung forward as if he'd been slammed in the back by a truck. He crashed into the tile, slid halfway across the mezzanine, and an incredible noise enveloped him while he was still airborne. A shockwave blasted his eardrums, and then the lights went out. 37. Zack Hightower lay on his side, shaking his head, trying to get his brain to clear. He didn't know what the hell had happened, but he was reasonably certain he and his team had not even begun their planned attack on the cops in the paddy wagon before everything went black. Shaking his head again, he slowly became aware that the van was now on its side, and he was lying on top of Jim Pace, next to an unconscious Pakistani police officer. The interior lighting had gone out, but the rear hatch of the paddy wagon was bent and partially open, letting a shaft of dusky light into the space. The men around him groaned. The faint light illuminated a smoky haze, but not much else in the back of the metal box. Zack looked around, struggling to do so because he was twisted and tangled among others with his hands behind his back. He focused on the man closest to him as the haze cleared. Pace had a broken nose, blood poured from it, but he was unable to wipe it, letting it instead drip down on the interior wall of the truck. Zack looked around for the other cop now. He was conscious but dazed, lying on top of Morgan, who himself didn't seem so clear-headed. Morgan tried to push himself up with his legs, but his limbs looked heavy and uncooperative. Zack knew there had been an explosion, but he didn't know if it had been the minibus itself or else an extremely powerful bomb placed inside the mall. He knew he wouldn't have his answer until he got the hell out of this tin can packed full of prostrate bodies. He couldn't see the driver or the front seat passenger of this vehicle because he was in the back of the paddy wagon. But with the obvious proximity of the explosion, he could imagine them injured or dead. Only the steel box he sat in had saved the lives of himself and his men. He spit dust to clear his mouth and shouted now.
"Who's up?"
Lennox was to his right.
"Two's good."
From the sound of his voice, he was no more or less disoriented than Zack.
"Three is up,"
Morgan said with a cough. He was next to the barely conscious cop, so Zack didn't wait for the others to sound off.
"Three, get that dude's handcuff key."
"On it,"
Morgan grunted and groaned as he struggled with the weight of the man, searching his utility belt for his key with his hands held behind his back. Pace's face was pressed up against Zack's face in the cramped space. Still, he said,
"I'm good, boss."
"Your nose is broken,"
Zack corrected without emotion, then called out to Rita's.
"Five, you alive?"
"Over here, boss."
He was behind Zack, close to the forward end of the vehicle.
"That shit sure rang my bell, but I'm good to go." "Got the keys,"
Morgan said, then used his forehead to smack the cop in the face to stop him from trying to fight back. Morgan uncuffed himself, then began crawling around the paddy wagon, freeing his teammates. This done, the men relieved the two Lahore cops of their MP5 submachine guns, their soft body armor, and their Browning pistols, and then they forced open the door of the paddy wagon and fell out into the parking lot. Smoke was everywhere. Vehicles burned, police sirens mixed with car alarms, and Zack could hear coughing and moaning in every direction. When he climbed to his feet, he sent Rita and Morgan to the front of the vehicle to check the driver and anyone else up there for usable weapons, and he looked through the smoke and impending darkness at the mall in front of him. The building was still standing, but all the glass was blown in at the entrance. Following the scatter path of debris and damage back into the parking lot, Zack had no trouble identifying Ground Zero. There was a large, smoking, burning pile of cars not far from the entrance, and even though he didn't see any trace of the minibus among them, he was certain that had been the source of the blast, its sacks of ammonium nitrate along with some kind of detonator, making a reasonably efficient bomb. There was no shooting in the mall at the moment, but Zack imagined that if Six had been anywhere near the entrance when that bus exploded, he might not be in a position to do much fighting at present. Morgan and Redis returned to the others armed with MP5s. The five ground branch officers stood in the haze, saw dead, injured, or just disoriented cops everywhere they looked, and then Zack strapped a subgun over his neck.
"What's our play, boss?"
Morgan asked as he put on Kevlar taken from one of the drivers. Zack finished donning his own soft body armor.
"We're going into that mall to find Six. Or to recover his body. Understood?"
"Understood,"
Rita said, then checked his MP5 and put the sling around his own neck. He didn't think much of Sierra 6, but his team leader had given an order, and he was going to carry it out or die trying. Court woke in a panic because he'd lost all situational awareness in the three-way gunfight he had been involved in. He lay face down on a cold tile floor. Some sort of ceiling light had fallen on top of him, but it was plastic and cheap aluminum and hadn't seemed to cause him any damage. But the smoke and the low light in the building made getting his bearings all but impossible. His only prayer was that his enemies were as disoriented as he was, because if they did have all their faculties, then he was fucked. The red jingle minibus had exploded outside, that much was obvious, but as to the disposition of the rest of the KRF fighters here in the mall, he didn't have a clue. He was relieved, however, when he realized he was lying on top of the Kalashnikov he'd gotten off the dead dude in the Nike store downstairs, so he fumbled with it a moment and brought it up to his shoulder. He pushed off the ground, back up to his knees, and tried to scan for threats. It was late dusk outside, and the power was off in the mall now, so there was little illumination beyond that which came from the burning cars at the entrance. He pressed the switch to turn on the weapon light and scanned around quickly to hunt for targets and to get his bearings, before turning it off again. Court rose awkwardly to his feet, spit a trickle of blood from his lips, then headed for the Tag Heuer store on weakened legs, telling himself this fight was still on, no matter what the hell had occurred outside. He was halfway to the store when a rifle cracked behind him and he threw himself back down to the ground. The guy in the optical store was still making trouble, but the poor lighting had obviously saved Court from catching a 7.62mm round to the back of his head. The man turned on the light of his AK, hunting for a better shot, and this gave Court the man's exact location. Court fired back, giving away his own location in the form of muzzle flashes, but he raked the area where he'd seen the terrorist's weapon light, desperate to force the man's head down, if nothing else. Zack was third in the stack behind Redis and Pace, and in front of Morgan and Lennox, as they entered an employee access door and began moving up a darkened hallway. There was no emergency lighting here in the mall, or at least none that was working, so the men activated the lights on the two MP5s that had them, and they pressed on. Gunfire above them, it was muted enough for Zack to surmise it was at least two floors up, gave them an idea of where they were heading first. They found a staircase and began moving that way. Then both lights quickly flipped off when the unmistakable sound of a metal door opening on the floor above them echoed in the tight space. Hightower and Redis had weapon lights. They waited to turn them back on, listening to the sound of multiple rushing footsteps under the metal stairwell and begin descending. Only when the footsteps told the Americans the people approaching were on the landing, not 10 feet away, did Redis, who was still the point man, actuate his flashlight. A group of 5 civilians, all covered with dust and sweat, and one man covered with blood from a wound above his eye, lurched back in surprise and began moving in the other direction. Hightower called out to them,
"Police! Police! Move past us and get out of here!"
The group slowed and stopped, spoke to one another in Urdu, and then did as they were told, though Zack was highly confident he and his men did not look like any local cops these civilians had ever seen. Zack and his team continued ascending, bypassing the second floor and heading up to the third, as more gunfire pounded around them in the mall. 38. Court Gentry was most of the way through his last magazine of Kalashnikov ammo, but the weapon remained on his shoulder as he scanned the darkness for a target. He'd managed to move away from the garbage can he'd been using for cover, concealing his retreat in the darkness and lingering smoke from both his rifle and the burning cars in the parking lot down 2 floors and off to his right. And now he was crouched behind a counter in a bakery. All around him, pies and cakes sat under glass display cases, while he wiped blood from his face with the shoulder of his t-shirt and then put his eye back in the red dot sight of his AK. Through the darkness of the blacked-out mall, and through the haze from the dust and smoke that enveloped it, Court recognized the movement, identified the form as being a person, and then squinted through the dust and through the display case he hid behind, searching to see if the man held a weapon. Finally, the shooter in the Tag Heuer shop made a mistake. Court had moved to the terrorist's left. He was across the mezzanine from him now and not down from it. But after a moment, he heard the crunching of shoes on glass. Just as he was about to turn on his light, confident that he would have a target to shoot, his enemy switched on his own light, but swung it around to the location where Court had been earlier. Court Gentry did not hesitate. He fired a single round from his weapon, hitting the man in the right side of his head, and the terrorist who'd had Court pinned for the past few minutes dropped where he'd stood. Court himself rose and began running out of the bakery, using the darkness and the smoke and the dust for cover, while he made his way towards a slow but rather steady series of AKs booming somewhere off to his left. He told himself he'd go down the stairs in the employee access hall on the opposite side, then head up to the fourth level, listening for gunfire to guide him on. Hightower and his team moved as a single entity out of a woman's clothing store on the third floor that was far enough away from the explosion to where the dust hung in the air, but the smoke had not reached. They avoided using their weapon lights as they entered the mezzanine, relying on any light that reached into this dark mall, plus their ears, listening for the telltale crunching of steps over broken glass, the rattle of sling swivels on a weapon, the whispered orders of one enemy to another. In the end, it wasn't the faint crunching of glass or the hushed whisper of the enemy, but a burst of gunfire off to their left. Redis was point, and he knew to move in that direction. The rest followed, and once they came around the T-section of the mall, he saw a muzzle flash out on the mezzanine in front of them. Hightower actuated the light on his MP5 now. The target was identified as a terrorist, and the five Americans cut the man down, but not before he executed a wounded shopkeeper in front of his store. Golf Sierra 5 rushed forward, kicked away the dead man's weapon, and then 4 shot the man once more in the chest for good measure. More gunfire erupted, but it wasn't coming from out in the mall. Instead, the booming echoed to their left, inside the employee access hall that ran behind every store here on the third level. The volume of fire indicated more than one shooter, and all 5 of the men recognized the sound of AKs. Hightower called to his point man in the front.
Dino!
Redis turned and began moving quickly, his weapon still to his shoulder, its stock pressed against the shoulder strap of his body armor. He rushed through a shoe store, found the back room, and moved carefully through this space, using his light here because he had no choice. He found the rear exit and entered the hallway, turned off his light, and began moving slowly and blindly back for the stairs. Court expended the last round of his AK at muzzle flashes across the open atrium here on the fourth floor of the mall. He'd taken fire and found cover in a cosmetic shop, diving behind a display just as hot rounds zipped inches from him. With his rifle empty, he drew his Glock again. He didn't want to get into a long-range gunfight with a guy wielding a rifle when he was armed with only a pistol, so he crawled along the floor until he got to the back room of the establishment. Here, he launched to his feet and ran to the exit, planning on racing back to the stairs to head back down. There was shooting there, sporadically, and Court thought that here he might be able to get the drop on one of the enemy and score himself another long gun. Once in the hallway, however, he realized he should have kept the rifle, if only for the light on its rail. It was near pitch-black darkness here, but he put his empty left hand on the wall and moved along as fast as he could, knowing the stairs were just ahead. He found them and began descending as quietly as possible, but a noise below him made him stop in his tracks. He had no doubts there were still civilians scrambling around here and there, so he wasn't sure he'd encountered the enemy, but the sound was unmistakably footsteps on the stairs themselves. He descended some more, and right when he began to turn for the landing, a brilliant light shone from just feet away. Court reached out with his free hand at the light, then put his hand around the steel barrel and polymer forestock of a Kalashnikov rifle, just behind the light. He ducked down to his right and shoved the weapon up and to his left. The gun cracked off, and Court felt the heat of the barrel scorch his fingers. He threw his body against the man on the landing, slamming him into the cinder block wall, though Court couldn't see his attacker at all after the light had shone right in his eyes. He jabbed his Glock hard against the man's gut. The rifle fired again, further burning Court's hand, and he pulled the trigger on his pistol, sending round after round after round into the terrorist's midsection. The man dropped his rifle and fell. Court stumbled over his falling body on the landing, bounced a shoulder against a wall, and turned towards the darkness where the stairwell continued down to the third floor. These terrorists had been moving in groups of 2, so he was worried another man would be coming up the stairs. Just then, a new white light blinded him from the hallway below, just 25 feet away, and Court instinctively fired 2 rounds at it. The light spun to the ground and extinguished, and he lined up to shoot where the man behind the light had probably fallen. But as he began pressing his trigger a third time, he heard a voice boom in the hall.
"Friendlies! Cease fire!"
It was Zack. Oh my God, Court thought. He'd just killed one of his teammates. He lowered his weapon quickly. Keith Morgan's voice rang out in the echoing hallway.
"5 is down!"
Court stood there on the landing, 25 feet from the men he'd taken for terrorists. Hightower shined his weapon light on the ceiling now, using its reflection against concrete to illuminate the entire section of the stairwell and hallway. Court holstered, then hurried to aid Dino Ritas, who was on the ground, on his back, and surrounded by his team. But Pace stepped forward, blocking him, using a submachine gun as a shield.
"Get the fuck back!"
he shouted. Court had engaged 5 men in 5 incidents in the last 5 minutes. He'd been blown across a mezzanine by a bomb. He'd witnessed more death and horror than ever before in his life, and he'd been hit in the eyes with a powerful light just seconds before, killing a man at contact distance. He had been in the process of rushing to aid yet more innocents under fire, and in the middle of this frenzy, he instinctively fired at a weapon light that clicked on in pitch-black darkness 25 feet away. Still, he knew the circumstances didn't matter. He'd shot a teammate. He knew he was in deep shit. To his relief, however, a groaning Dino Ritas spoke from the floor.
"Both rounds caught my soft armor. Fuck, that hurt!"
Zack felt under the man's armor quickly.
"No blood. Ribs don't feel broken. Guys, get him up."
Sierra 5 was pulled to his feet by Morgan and Lennox, and he looked at Court in the low light as he himself rubbed his hand under the soft body armor he'd taken from the Pakistani cop.
"You motherfucker!"
Court said nothing. Morgan shouted.
"I told you this prick would fuck up and someone would—"
Zack moved forward now, pushing past Lennox.
"Everybody calm the fuck down. Ritas, you're fine. Morgan, we've got work to do. You too, Six. We'll deal with this after."
"Copy,"
Court said softly. Just then, another rattling of gunfire erupted back on the level above them. Zack grabbed Court by the shoulder and pushed him forward. Zack said,
"Six, you're on point with your Glock. We clean the last of these fuckers out of here and then we slip the cops outside."
"Easy day," Court said.
He was being sarcastic, but Zack didn't seem to pick up on it. He said,
"Easy day."
The Golf Sierra team shot an armed man on the 4th level. A single round from Lennox hit him low, in either the pelvis or the leg. But the man's partner was across the mezzanine, and he engaged the Americans, forcing them into a tea shop. Both terrorists disengaged, the wounded man no doubt crawling off to hide, and the ambulatory fighter racing south in the mall, surely on the hunt for easier prey. The Americans found the ambulatory man a couple of minutes later. They were down on the 2nd floor, but they followed the booms and flashes of gunfire to locate the man by the escalator Court had leapt off minutes before. He was in the process of shooting dead bodies, having no more living targets in sight. To Court, the man seemed to be biding his time, waiting for someone to come up here and fight him. Golf Sierra obliged, cutting the young man down with a fusillade from a 6 weapons. But in the end, it was the local cops who finally attacked the mall and found the last terrorist wounded in a McDonald's in the food court. He'd been shot through both legs by Lennox minutes earlier, and then he'd retreated up here in the dark to make his last stand. As the poorly trained police moved on him, he managed to injure 2 with his AK before a 12 pistols and rifles sprayed into the McDonald's, finally finishing the KRF fighter at close range with a shotgun blast to the chest. Golf Sierra used the cacophony of gunfire as a distraction to leave the mall via a back door. There was a police cordon around the place, but it was full of holes, and the men crouched between parked cars on the opposite side of the wrecked main entrance, making their way through the lot between a pair of Lahore City police vehicles and men crouched behind them, until they were out of sight of the cops and could stand up and move normally. The men hot-wired an old delivery truck in a strip mall next door. Pace climbed behind the wheel, his bloody nose now stanched with a couple of torn pieces of his t-shirt that he'd crammed into his nostrils. They drove off, melting into traffic on Nazaria E. Pakistan Avenue, which had not been altogether affected by the explosion or the attack at a mall 1/2 mile to the east. It was only after another line of Pakistani police vehicles raced past them, indicating finally that they had not been spotted during their escape, that Pace asked his TL the question the whole team must have been asking themselves.
"Where to, boss?"
"Straight to the airport. If Hanley doesn't already have extraction waiting for us, then he will by the time we get there."
Ritas was seated next to Gentry in the back of the van.
"Yo, Six. If it took me catching a double tap from your gun to get your ass out of our lives, then I'm cool with that."
"You took one for the team, Dino,"
Morgan quipped from the back of the van.
"2, actually."
And then to Court, he said,
"You're out of here."
Court said nothing, and Hightower looked back from the front passenger seat at his Six.
"Your mouth is bleeding. You hurt anywhere else?"
No, I don't think so. What did you find at the hotel?
We didn't get in. Somebody called 5-0 on us.
I didn't get compromised.
I know. I'm going to have to talk with Hanley. My bet is ISI got word we were operating, and they weren't going to let that happen.
Zack continued looking at Court in the low light. The younger man's eyes were distant, the veins in his neck throbbed, and he trembled. Zack said,
You're okay, Six. It's over. You did good.
Rita said,
Good? Are you kidding?
Zack silenced his man with a hard stare. Softly, almost to himself, Court said,
I've never seen anything like that.
Lennox spoke from the driver's seat.
You don't really get used to it, but you kinda do. Just concentrate on breathing. Think about getting the hell out of Pakistan, because that's what matters now. We'll save everything else for later.
Rita said,
But...
Lennox's voice boomed, every bit as loud as Hightower's.
I said later!
The men drove on, the sound of sirens fading into the distance behind them. 39. Present day. It was just past 12:45 in the morning when the lone figure appeared in the dark in the central Mumbai residential and industrial development of Bandra Kurla Complex. He had walked the length of the wall outside the American School of Bombay, but then he turned around and began heading back, avoiding bored-looking security guards at a gatehouse by climbing a fence just south of their position. He then moved across several tennis courts, remaining in the shadows, towards a row of small buildings. Court had learned from Matt Hanley that the ex-CIA man he was coming to meet, Ted Appleton, was now a teacher here at the school and benefited from this chiefly by living in a bungalow on campus along the banks of the Mithi River, which snaked through central Mumbai from north to south. He found the unit he was looking for. It was as still and quiet as all the other bungalows running up and down both sides of the little road, and then he moved through thick palms to make his way to a narrow corridor between the home itself and a wooden fence. He stepped onto the porch, where he saw a small sign on a stake stuck into a rock garden by the front door, proudly announcing that the property was protected by a security system. Noting the company of the system on the stake itself, he determined he could disable it simply by finding the electronic junction box that would likely be on the wall of the home somewhere around back. He moved between the eastern side of the bungalow and the old rickety wooden fence that partitioned the property from the next one, ducked under a ground floor air conditioning unit, then made his way to the back, where he found not only the box to the security system that he'd hoped to find, but also a rear entrance to the home and a view to the west. The rear of the property ended abruptly, falling down a steeply sloped riverbank that looked over the Mithi, although this was not a selling point of the property. The reed-filled and murky body of water was no great sight to see, and on the far bank, some 50 yards away, Court saw electric lighting illuminating some sort of massive car junkyard, an apocalyptic view from the back windows of Appleton's bungalow. He turned away from the tiny backyard and the water and focused his attention on the box. He used a multi-tool to open it, then looked the wires over carefully with a small penlight. Determining which one to cut to remove main power and which one to cut to extinguish the backup battery, he pushed through the dummy wires that would set off the alarm and made two quick snips. This done, he retraced his steps in the dark, back around the side of the building, returning to the air conditioning unit. Court climbed up on top of the warm box, placed his hand on the beams holding the AC unit directly above in a second floor window, and pulled himself up, using his deeply treaded hiking boots against the wall to help him with his climb. Standing on the upstairs AC, he tried the window next to it and found it locked. Taking his time to pry it open carefully with his multi-tool, he entered a cluttered little office. A minute later, he found a man asleep in the next room. He was alone, which made this easier, but Court had no idea what Appleton looked like, so he wasn't about to start complimenting himself yet on a job well done. Court pulled a chair up next to the man's bed, then quietly opened the man's side table, double-checking that there was no weapon there. There was nothing on or in the nightstand other than an asthma inhaler, more books and magazines, a pair of reading glasses, and a glass of water. Already Court was getting the idea that coming to talk to this old professor was going to be a dry hole. He'd been a CIA station chief 12 years ago, But now he looked exactly like what he was, an academic pushing back against impending retirement. Annoyed that he'd likely wasted his time, he pulled out his Browning high-power pistol, reached over to the sleeping man, and tapped him once on the forehead, roughly. The man stirred, took a few seconds to open his eyes, then looked around the room to determine what had awakened him. He saw a man in a black hoodie sitting 3 feet away, a gun held between his knees. The older man lurched back but said nothing. Court said,
"If you have a weapon stashed under a pillow, reaching for it is going to work out exactly the opposite way you'd always dreamed it would."
The man blinked a few times, but still he said nothing.
"I need to talk to you."
Now he spoke, his voice raspy with age and sleep.
Who are you?"
"The question is, who are you?"
Still hoarsely, the man said,
"I'm Appleton."
"Good."
Court slid his gun back into his waistband. The man sat up in bed. He seemed nervous, but not overly so.
"Do we know one another?"
"No. Matt Hanley sent me."
At this, the man sat up straighter.
"Hanley? That bastard?"
Court gave a tired smile.
"That bastard.
Can I put on my glasses?"
"Be my guest."
Appleton put them on, smoothed out the thin wisps of hair on his head as best he could, then pushed the covers off him.
"I heard Hanley got the boot from the 7th floor, sent down to be the station chief of Papua, was it?"
"I'm not here to talk about New Guinea."
Appleton shrugged.
"What does Hanley want from me?"
"It's not like that. I need some information about activities here in Mumbai. He says you are the man to talk to."
The older man raised both eyebrows, then looked around at his tiny little room in his small home.
"Does it look like I've been keeping my finger on the pulse of Mumbai? Hanley knows I've been retired for a long time. In the old days, sure, the Indian subcontinent was my beat for over a decade. But now..."
His voice trailed off, but Court said,
"What I want to talk about is the old days."
Appleton cracked a little smile.
"Ah, if it's ancient history you want, then maybe I am your man. Go on."
12 years ago, Pakistan."
Appleton's smile disappeared.
"What about it?"
"I was there. I was ground branch."
Now the man in bed blinked hard.
"You look too young to have been in Gulf Sierra back then."
"Trust me, I got that a lot."
The former station chief shook his head.
"I don't believe you."
"The Goldberg Galleria."
"What about it?"
"There was one agency asset who wasn't captured at the KRF safe house. One guy who made it to the Galleria before the bomb went off."
Appleton cocked his head.
"I remember all that. So?"
Court just said, "Me."
"What was your call sign? Be careful, because I remember the after-action report."
"Gulf Sierra 6.
"Oh my God,"
Appleton muttered softly.
"Sierra 6. You?"
"Me."
The man in the bed took a long time before speaking. Finally, he said,
"Are you here to kill me?"
Court cocked his head. This he hadn't expected.
"Why? What did you do?"
The older man hesitated, then said,
"I don't know how you see things that happened back then. Was it your fault? Everything that happened? I could have made some different decisions. Would that have changed the outcome? I don't know."
He sniffed.
"It's what I do with my free time now. Try to determine where I went wrong back then."
After a moment, he added,
"Those poor people."
"Yeah," Court said. "Except, it's not over."
Now Appleton was the one who cocked his head.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
Court said,
"Murad Khan is still alive."
When Court told this to Arjun, and when Court told this to Hanley, both men had clearly been astonished and doubtful, at least at first. But Appleton said nothing. He made no reaction.
"You don't seem surprised,"
Court said.
"Nothing surprises me anymore. Did I know? No. But did I suspect ISI was lying to us back then when they offered up some trace DNA as proof of his death? Yes. I've always harbored doubts.
He shrugged.
It's what led to the fast track for my early retirement.
Meaning?
Meaning I wouldn't shut up about it, and I got the axe.
He shrugged.
That and other things. Again, I could have handled myself too.